Welcome to our first segment of this afternoon's program. It's Sunday, the 13th of February, 2022. It is now 1:02 p.m. in the studio. I am your host, Kieran Murdoch. Leader of the Opposition in Parliament, Jamal Pringle, opened Thursday's debate on the 2022 budget by accusing the government of not being people-focused. Pringle, who is the Member of Parliament for All Saints East and St. Luke, said that the $1.64 billion election budget, as he called it, did not address direct assistance for residents who have been facing hard times since the pandemic, or how the ruling administration planned to combat the high cost of living in the country. The opposition leader argued that the government could have stepped in, for instance, to ask Social Security to freeze its increase for this year until the economy got a bit better. Pringle also argued that an effort should have been made to widen social programs based on the number of people who are out of work. He also lashed out at the government for failing to introduce in the budget ways to diversify the economy, particularly, he said, through agriculture, given the increase in that industry's growth. Now, the 2022 budget, of course, is $1.64 billion, as stated before, and it is increased from the 2021 budget, which was $1.4 billion, which was a significant reduction, of course, based on the fact that COVID-19 was and still is a significant problem. For some context, as we stated last week, the planned expenditure in 2020, prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, was $1.7 billion. This year, the government has promised to stimulate economic activity through spending on works and public projects. As such, the capital expenditure in this year's budget is quite significant and has more than doubled from what it was last year. That's expenditure that's going to be on roads and infrastructure projects. No changes were announced regarding taxation. So, like I said, on this segment, we are continuing the discussion that we began last week in terms of the 2022 budget statement. And our focus, or at least part of our focus this afternoon, is going to be on the opposition in Parliament's response to the budget. We're happy to be joined by four panelists for our discussion this afternoon. I have with me in studio our first panelist, Ms. Petra Williams. Ms. Petra Williams, of course, is an economist and statistician by training, and she's also a business management consultant. We're happy to have her join us in studio this afternoon. Good afternoon to you, Ms. Petra Williams.
Good afternoon, Kieran. It's good to see you in person and join you in studio. Good afternoon to my colleague guests and to our listening and our audience.
I will ask our other remaining guests to unmute their microphones at this point because our other remaining guests are joining us on Zoom. I will introduce, of course, Mr. David Spencer. Mr. David Spencer is a community activist. He's also the co-host of Movement Radio, which is a weekly program on Observer Radio dedicated to social and political activism on a range of issues. Good afternoon to you, Mr. David Spencer. How are you doing?
Good afternoon, Kieran. Good afternoon to Peter Williams, Mr. Fontaine, and Carla Knight. Good afternoon to Antigua and Barbuda, and wherever your radio station is being heard. I am very well, thank you, Mr. Murdoch.
We have joining us as well Mr. Carla Knight, socioeconomic and political affairs commentator. Good afternoon to you, Mr. Knight. How are you doing?
Good afternoon to Kieran and to Antigua and Barbuda and my fellow panelists, and to all who may be listening to this program. A pleasant good afternoon to you.
And finally, of course, good afternoon to Dr. Thompson Fontaine, an economist at Dominica National, formerly worked at the International Monetary Fund for, I think, 13 years. And his work and writing, folks, have focused on issues such as growth, currency crises, development, fiscal management, and debt. And, of course, he was previously a senator in Dominica as well. I think he's currently working in South Sudan, from my last recollection. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Thompson Fontaine. How are you doing?
Good afternoon to you, Kieran, and to your listeners, as well as to my fellow panelists. It's great to be with you again this afternoon.
Mr. David Spencer, I wonder if I could begin with you. I just want to give you an opportunity. I know that Mr. Knight and Dr. Fontaine were with us last week, but I want to give you an opportunity just to give us your impression of the actual budget statement for 2022. As Ms. Williams and I were discussing before we began, we don't have all the estimates as yet, but the statement itself, what was your impression?
So one struggles to get past the overindulgence in self-praise. All right. And once one has done that, clearly there are a number of things that stand out. The need to catch up with the infrastructural investment in infrastructure. And we've heard, you know, the complaints up and down the length and breadth of Antigua with respect to water, with respect to the poor road conditions, with respect to the neglect in the inner villages and inner core of St. John. So clearly, government needs to catch up in terms of that area. But again, as well, there seems to be, in my view, an approach that panders to big business while ignoring the plight and pleas of the little people. And let us not forget that when we look in the realm of political economy, we're reminded that we need to look at three variables and to ask if they're being addressed and to what extent they are. The issue of poverty, so whether poverty is being addressed, unemployment, and inequality, the extent to which these will be tackled, these will be reduced, is an important issue. I don't know that they're significantly addressed, maybe the employment factor, but the issue of poverty and inequality are very glaring issues that need to be addressed in Antigua and Barbuda. And I'm not certain that those are looked at, those are being addressed within the budget, which really is a tool for government intervention in the economy within the fiscal year. And given the structure of its budget and the proposed measures that I have seen in it, the question is whether the challenges that currently affect the Antiguan people will be effectively addressed and whether the platform will be laid for the continued sustainable development of Antigua and Barbuda.
Peter Williams, I will ask our guests just to mute their microphones in the meantime. Mr. David Spencer has just described the budget as a tool for government intervention in the economy and society. How would you describe a budget? What is a budget supposed to be? And if you would give me any sense of your first impressions of the budget, and even to explain why, as we started or before we started, where you said you usually like to wait for the estimates to get a fuller sense of what goes on. But what should we be looking for when we go into any government's budget?
Well, in essence, the budget is designed to reflect the government's plans for its execution of its fiscal policy. Most countries' fiscal and monetary policy to impact the overall economy, because especially in small economies such as ours, where the government goes, to a large extent, the government goes unless we have significant volumes of foreign direct investment. So from the general framework perspective, without perhaps veering too far off topic, before I get there, and in our case, in our region's case, the budget also reflects for us the report when the administration, the political administration who's in government, and I think we need to remember that, when they also give the report card of their performance. So, in Antigua and Barbuda, when various administrations get slammed for the political pontifications in the budgets, I smile, because political pontification has been a feature of the budgets of Antigua and Barbuda from since I was a child. And I predate 1981 independence. So I'm putting that on the record because I don't think we should be overly worried about the fact that there were political posturing and partisan displays in the budget. It has been the thing that has happened in Antigua over time. Just for comparatives, because when the Prime Minister and Minister of Finance was presenting his budget this year, when he went into the third hour, closing out the third hour.
It was like 3 hours and 17 minutes.
Right. So when he was closing out the third hour, one of, remember, former Minister of Finance, Errol Cott, one of his budgets came to mind when he actually went to 4 hours. I don't know if anybody remembers that. And I was like, I wonder if we're going to get a record. That was just my thought. So I'm saying that in terms of the length to which some finance ministers, and then, of course, there is the comparison where our national hero, Surveyor, he did a budget, I think, was 7 or 17 minutes. So we have had extremes. And I'm bringing that up just to context for all of us, the extremes to which we can go in our budget presentations. So I would not be overly concerned or worried about the political colorings throughout the presentation. I think the substantial things that we would have looked for, and I think some of it was raised last week by the panel without me going to call too much into it. I think the substantial things that we would have looked for, and I think some of it was raised last week by the panel.
Yeah, Joe, we're...
Okay, so the critical things would be, were we able to identify what the government's fiscal outlook is? Were we able to see where the government is looking in terms of its capital expenditure? Were we able to see where the government is looking in terms of addressing things like welfare? Mr. Spencer raised a few in terms of the welfare issue for the overall economy. Were we able to look to see how the government intends to further stimulate growth in the economy? And those, especially the latter, would have been of particular significance, given that we're coming out of a virtual lockdown of not only our economy, but internationally as a result of COVID. So I think that would have been, for me, the major looks. The one other thing that always interests me is because we know that our payroll is always a significant component of our national budget, payroll as it is, regardless of the ministries, which is one of the reasons why I said I'm looking forward to the breakdown, because I want to see how we're able to program funds beyond just payroll. So the government says it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 initiatives it wants to roll out. How are we now going to program funds to actually execute those initiatives beyond just paying staff? I think in a summary, that would be my general look. In terms of now for this particular budget that we just had, and in the absence of the more refined numbers for me, the three things that stand out for me would have been, well, I'm picking three. One, and the debt, in terms of the deficit, the financing of the debt. I noted that there are some other amounts mentioned throughout the budget as it relates to additional investment coming in from the government that I did not see reflected in those numbers. And so for me, I would want to go behind of those a bit more. That is one. Two, I note in terms of the government projecting our growth, the growth sectors were also of interest to me in that whole outlook. And the other thing would be of interest to me that there are no quote-unquote new taxes, but we know that the overall increase in the amounts to be collected is likely because cost of living and the cost of doing business just to come into Antigua is going to grow up. And so by default, that will mean that the taxes coming in would also increase, which is going to impact our cost of living.
Mr. Colin Knight, to bring you in, and it's a question sort of also on the budget statement itself before we delve into how the opposition in Parliament dealt with it. But Mr. Spencer spoke about three specific issues in terms of his analysis of the budget. He spoke about poverty, unemployment, and inequality. And I take note of the fact that you often make reference to these issues in terms of it being a priority for the governments in developing countries to take a particular and deliberate approach to address poverty, inequality, and clearly unemployment. Do you agree with his statement in terms of those three things? And, summarily, the extent to which those things were addressed in the budget statement, are you satisfied with the extent to which they were addressed, if you think they were addressed significantly?
Well, I just echo the sentiments I suggested last week. I think that one of the critical things that I was looking for in the budget that, to my mind, wasn't sufficiently addressed was the sort of measures to tackle inequality and to tackle poverty alleviation. There were some things that were mentioned, particularly when they spoke about the COVID relief measures that they put into place. But these were largely temporary sort of stopgap measures to deal with that particular crisis. There's a huge debate, and perhaps when we get into the opposition part of it, we'll talk about the absence of a stimulus and whether that was a good strategy or not. But certainly, when you talk about growth, a lot of emphasis has been on growth, and I note that a lot of commentators have been talking about this idea of a growth. Although the United Progressive Party have questioned the growth figures. Growth is good because largely if the economy is growing, it means that there's probably more people in work. And that of course is a good thing in terms of the alleviation of poverty. But you can also have situations of growth without development. You could have growth and is not pro-poor growth. So it's growth, but it's heavily skewed towards certain individuals, certain sectors that are benefiting from growth. And so the question is really, which sectors of the economy are in fact seeing growth? I mentioned the idea, I mentioned that there was a sort of a contradiction that I noted, that while the budget was talking about a very large percentage increase in growth, it noted a fall in consumption revenue, a fall in consumption tax revenues, which kind of suggests to me that you have economic growth, but still there may be variables in the economy that are not impacted. So people are not spending. And why are people not spending? These are questions that are important to find out. Of course, in the context of a pandemic, people might be engaging in kind of precautionary savings. But, you know, it's, I also think that, you know, coming out of a coming out of a pandemic, you're going to always see this sort of a bounce effect in groups. As you open up the economy, a lot of the pent-up demand will happen, and so you will see this sort of spike in growth. So, you know, there needs to be far more comprehensive analysis in terms of which are the sectors that are benefiting from this growth, which are the groups that are benefiting, what is the government doing to address the cost of living? That's a very big issue. The issue of utilities, all of these different aspects of the economy that particularly affect the poorest groups in the society. And so I would agree with Mr. Spencer on that point, that we needed to see much more analysis of that. But of course, as Petra said, this is a statement. It's not the full sort of estimates, and which is a lot much, much more comprehensive document. So I hope that when we get much more statistics published, you'd see far more of a breakdown of how the budget actually impacted various groups in society and the government's plans to address particularly the issue of inequality, which I think Antigua-Barbuda has one of the highest rates of inequality in the sub-region, but I think in the wider Caribbean as well.
Dr. Thompson Fontaine, we can pivot a bit now to particularly the opposition in Parliament. I speak specifically to Leader of the Opposition, the Honourable Jamal Pringle. One of the things that both he and, of course, his party, the main opposition party, the United Progressive Party, have pushed since the pandemic, I remember it from last year's budget, in their response, was the issue of stimulus. And he mentioned it again this year when he spoke about small businesses and a number of other issues. But he said that there was an absence of job security in the private and public sector in Antigua and Barbuda. These are his words. And he said that it was time that the government put stimulus measures in place. It's a call that's been made repeatedly. I'm curious as to what extent you feel that that is an appropriate and a realistic call to be made upon the government. And you could perhaps compare the positions of Antigua and Barbuda with the positions of any other island in the Eastern Caribbean, and you know, whether or not we should be in a position to offer any form of stimulus.
Yes, you know, Kieran, that's a very interesting question, because this is something that I think a number of governments have been wrestling with, whether or not they should, in fact, provide a stimulus. And a number of people, not only in Antigua, but in the other Caribbean islands, have been calling on the governments to provide just such a stimulus. The question then becomes, where exactly is the government going to get this kind of money to pay the stimulus, and to what end? I know that in the budget speech of the Prime Minister, he indicated that he was able to maintain the payroll. In other words, no public servants were let go. So in that case, it reduces the emphasis the government having to pay a stimulus. On the other hand, the private sector was looking for some kind of jolt, some kind of stimulus. But at the same time, as we noted in the past year, the tourism sector, which is by far the largest operational sector of the Antiguan economy, actually rebounded to some extent. So I believe that the argument for Antigua may not be a very good one, in the sense that where we would have expected the government to have probably stepped in was if there were massive layoffs, for example, that would have reason to provide a stimulus. But the absence of layoffs and the fact that the economy, or at least the tourism sector, is recovering, that also reduces the emphasis on the stimulus package. But within the context of government's fiscal policy, though, it was interesting to note that the spending that is being laid out in the government's budget is geared towards really stimulating economic growth. But I know that the opposition leader was very skeptical of that particular policy. he felt that the budget does not offer any hope to the average income earner in Antigua. And he lamented the fact, for example, that the LIAT workers have been able to receive their severance payments. He talked about the plight of workers not being able to really benefit. I think what we're going to see as we go forward is that, in especially for Antigua and the rest of the Caribbeans, is the fact that the inflation rate is going up. Everything, and because we rely so heavily on importation, it means that effectively we're going to have an increasing price levels within the Caribbean islands. What this effectively means is that if you do not have the consequent wage increases, that people's real incomes are going to start falling. And that's a very real danger. And that is probably something, instead of a stimulus, government could probably look to adjust wages that would be able to confront the increase in prices.
Mr. David Spencer, another issue that the opposition leader dealt with quite specifically was the issue of growth and whether or not growth had really been something that had impacted and been felt amongst the population. We've spoken about it to some extent as we've started this discussion this afternoon. I'm quoting from his presentation here. He says growth can occur every year without the population feeling it in their pockets or seeing it on their table. All it takes is a few projects, and he mentions a few. He says the PLH project in Barbuda, or development at the port, there's in the port expansion and construction project, or the Yida development, in order to create this idea that, you know, the economy is growing and it's, you know, it's booming by millions and millions, but it's not necessarily being felt across the board by the people who need it most. What did you think of that point? Do you think that was a fair point to make? Your impressions?
Yes, I think it's a fair point to make, but it has to be put in context. In the context of course, that when it's convenient, we have cited, the whole issue of growth as, you know, as and challenge that, and all the measures that are related to the issue of growth, per capita income as a measurement of development. We've challenged that when it's convenient, because we know that per capita income also can contain within it the occlusion of the issue of the distribution of wealth. And so I can understand Mr. Pringle making that in the context of saying the growth must spread, it must, you know, affect all the sectors of the economy rather than just a simple a few persons. And Mr. Knight also elaborated on that, the whole issue of inequality, the whole issue of skewed distribution of wealth that happens in Antigua. And even the Prime Minister has from time to time pointed to the fact that, I think at some point he said 65% of the population of Antigua was earning less than $3,000 per month. And on another occasion, it was pointed out that only about 8% of the Antiguan population was taking home more than $5,000 EC dollars per month. So that the comment is important, that when growth takes place in the economy, the effect has to be felt throughout the length and breadth of the country, and that eventually it has to trickle down to, well, hey, I don't generally use this trickle down explanation in my language. You know, I mean, I believe in a bottom up kind of approach, so that if we're going to look at people who are going to benefit from what takes place in the country, it has got to be, the focus has to be on the people, the poor, the middle class, small businesses, and that in the, what we have seen, and I see it being articulated in the budget speech, where the Prime Minister pointed out that the government policy was able to stimulate investment and expansion in the hotel plans in the country. And yes, we need the hotel industry to rebound and to take off and so on, because it is still our main industry. But we also have to ensure in our planning and the use of all measures by the government that we address the conditions of the people at the bottom.
Ms. Peter Williams, anything you want to add to at this point?
I am in the process of conducting a very interesting assessment that I'd probably want to share summary as we look at the whole issue of income inequality and whether or not, well, the full extent of the impact on our local economy. So we look at our per capita income, and the per capita income seeks to just look at how our GDP is measured over the population, right? Here are some points that I want us to consider as we look at the whole issue of income inequality. As in many countries around the region and in the world, education is at no direct cost to most persons who are in the education system. Or in many instances, it's subsidized. And the reason why I say at no direct cost, because of course the government picks up the tab, which by default comes from tax revenue. So if we look at the reality of us having universal primary and secondary education, and we then work out the cost for the government of each child in the secondary system, the cost to the government of each child in the primary system, and we assume then that these parents then do not have to account directly out of their income for the education of their children, the cost of the textbooks, the cost of all the others associated with that, because education is one of the most critical factors, which is a game changer in terms of our quality of life and all of those things. If we look at the fact that rather than putting an increase in salaries in persons' pockets, we have now gone to the issue of tertiary education, the delivery of tertiary education at highly subsidized rates. How does that figure in the whole conversations of inequality and the distribution of income? If we also look at our health care services, and we're looking at, we've gone now beyond primary and secondary, the delivery of primary and secondary health care. We're now going more into some specialized health services, which otherwise would cost us significant sums to deliver. And if we were to compare the average amount that we benefit from in terms of the quote unquote no cost health care versus how much we pay individually in medical benefits, we could then begin to have a conversation about the income, the use of goods and services, and then the notion of the inequality that exists. Because let's say, for example, that persons were given more basic income. So our minimum wage in Antigua and Barbuda is just about $8.25 an hour. I think it's the third in the ranking across our CARICOM countries. So if we're saying that we would like
third highest or third lowest?
Highest. Mm-hmm. Highest. Third highest. So if we're looking at that, we would like that to increase, because I believe in being practical, I would love to have the conversation about increasing that. But at what cost? And at what cost to whom? Do we then determine, okay, we are no longer going to provide this slew of public goods, which we have a broad base provision of public goods. And I'm saying that this has been happening over administrations. As each administration has come into bear, the range of goods and services available to the public has increased over time. That has to be covered by someone, somewhere. And the coverage of that is also included in our deficit position. And I'm raising that as we look at the whole conversation about the capacity of the government to deliver more goods and services.
I wanted to ask a question at this point. It's been on my mind, and that is the extent to which, when generally in politics, politicians talk to each other about different programs that they should be attempting, social programs to uplift people, the extent to which that does not necessarily take into account existing programs which have simply become the norm.
Yep.
And so they're no longer thought about. I mean, I was jotting down some here. You mentioned the fact that there's universal primary and secondary education, medical benefits, there's social security, there's government programs for entrepreneurs in terms of grants, there's housing programs,
many
there's
of which programs we now for take for granted,
indigent, right. There's land distribution programs, there's affordable housing programs, there's scholarships given out. Of course, these things are not exclusive to any administration.
No,
they've been building themselves
right.
over time. So I wonder if we've gotten to the point where, especially when you couple that with the fact that we have a bloated public sector, and I do notice that political individuals in this country tend to either acknowledge or deny that at various points. So
depending
at various
on
points,
where
you
they
could,
stand.
Yeah, you could find them acknowledging that, say, like, this is clear, we obviously have bloated. And then other times they're like, no, no, not so much. But anyway, based on the fact that we have a bloated public sector and that the wage bill is such a significant portion of what the government has to pay out in every budget, that the government is not very nimble in what it really can do on a yearly basis. So, would you agree with that statement?
So you were coming to the point that I was going to wrap it all by saying, because at the end of the day, we still have too few rich resources chasing all the dreams and visions of all of us. And layering on that is a reality that is ahead of us. Dr. Fontaine mentioned it. I think I mentioned it in my opening, that the cost of living, just the sheer cost of living that we're going to import onto ourselves is going to go up. We're not discussing what we're going to do internally now. The logistics is going to drive goods and services, the cost up. The cost of raw materials, and we're still seeing the impact of COVID in the primary producing countries. Those are all going to drive the cost of living on us up. So if we look on layering all of that on an already challenged system, do we then want to seriously now, today, have a conversation about increasing wages? Because once wages are increased, at the back end, there has to be the funding of those increases, which means in the private sector, either prices are going to go up, or is there a presumption that the owners of enterprises are going to absorb the increase without looking at their profitability? And in the case of the public sector, if the government has to fund wage increases when we already have a $600 million financing gap,
what do you think of that gap?
Who is going to cover that?
What do you think about that gap? I mean, it's a $1.6 billion budget and $600 million of it is to be raised.
Deficit financing?
Yes.
And if you look at the budget, clearly there may be other avenues that needs financing too, which is what I'm telling you. I'm not ready to comment on that yet until I see all the numbers. It's scary enough as it is.
Mr. Knight, in terms of, anything you want to respond to, but also in terms of some of the critical points that the opposition leader raised in response to the budget, what's your take?
So I want to go back to this whole idea of a stimulus, because I think the narrative has been put out there that in the absence of a stimulus, the government of Antigua and Barbuda did absolutely nothing for people during the pandemic. And I think it's a false narrative. So there are obvious policy choices that a government has to make based on its own fiscal circumstances and based on its own sorts of ideology or philosophy about how it deals with any kind of an economic crisis. Now, I don't want to get too technical and largely because we have a PhD economist on the panel, but I think it's safe to say that you have business cycles, and with any business cycles, you also have shock absorbers. So when you have a downturn in the economy, there are existing fiscal policy measures that are supposed to act as shock absorbers or insurance policies to buffer the effect or combat the effect of a negative downturn in the economy. Then you also have this idea of a fiscal stimulus, which is to say that you can either have it on the monetary side, so the central bank will inject the stimulus by either printing money or quantitative easing or any of those kinds of policies, or fiscal stimulus where the government will sort of give people direct injections of cash, either through a transfer program or some kind of check or something like we saw in America. Now, what the government of Antigua and Barbuda, so the debate in Antigua and Barbuda was whether or not we utilize the existing shock absorbers as a measure. And you can look at the budget and clearly see that what the prime minister sort of felt was that we have existing shock absorbers that should be competent enough to deal with the challenges of a pandemic. We have unemployment benefits, we have other food, we have transfer programs. There was a sort of a list of them that he mentioned in the budget statements. And what happens in a downswing in the economy is that you have an expansion of these shock absorbers, right? So you have an expansion of the amount of money because there are going to be more claims. So there are more claims for unemployment benefits, there are more claims for poverty relief measures, there are more claims that the government will have to spend to deal with the people who are affected by the pandemic through these existing measures. The government gave out food hampers, although you can argue whether or not that was a better policy in terms of whether you should give them direct cash or food hampers. Gave them food hampers. It did the whole idea of expanding the existing measures in terms of poverty relief and alleviation. It had the GAP program and a whole series of measures that they had in place. what the Prime Minister was very clear on was that, and you listen to his statements, he was not going to be incurring extra borrowing to finance any kind of fiscal injection and at the same time put this country in more debt. Now, you can debate that, right? But that's a choice. That's a debate. So it's a question of where's the money? Because rightfully, the debate has to be, where's the money going to come from for this stimulus? Government gets most of its revenue from tax receipts. Tax receipts naturally fall in the case of a downturn in the economy. So most of that supplemental income is going to come from external sources. Either you're going to borrow it from international capital markets or get it from somewhere else, right? When you borrow money, you have to pay it back, and you pay it back with interest. So there's no free lunch, and we seem to be looking at these things as if it's a free lunch, and there's no free lunch. You make the trade-off as to how you manage the economy during the downturn. I think what the Prime Minister was trying to say is, well, listen, we need to focus on keeping people employed and keeping people and getting the economy as open as quickly as possible, such that we can get through this pandemic as quickly as possible. You look at the vaccination rate. Antigua and Barbuda had one of the most successful vaccination rates in the OECS in the wider Caribbean region. We had one of the first economies to begin opening up the economy, to begin allowing more flights. So it was clear that the government's position was, we are not going to be incurring more. So he even said it, you know, when he was responding to a question about, you know, well, you know, Timothy Harris has given his people stimuluses, and he said, well, let them go ahead and spend. Let them go ahead and spend. The day of reckoning will come for them. We will manage our little resources as best as we can and try to get our economy open as quickly as possible to keep people and get people back into work, such that that was the best strategy for it. And I don't have, I mean, we can have a debate on the merits and demerits of the strategy, but what I want to leave with people is the idea that if you want a stimulus and you want to give direct check transfers, we're not America, we can't give every citizen $1,800 in a direct check, right? It's just not fiscally feasible. And so you have to think about, well, what does it mean in terms of the medium, the short term, the medium term, and the long term impacts of this? And so I don't want people to get the impression that this was done out of spite. These are policy decisions that you have to debate the pros and cons about. And I would hope that we would think more critically about these decisions rather than say, well, you know, we didn't give a stimulus, we didn't do anything, we let poor people suffer. I don't think that was necessarily intentionally, if you're going to be accurate.
Dr. Fontaine, again, of course, feel free to respond to anything. I want to ask you, what do you think would have been some of the best weaknesses or openings in the budget statement as it has been presented so far that the opposition could have capitalized upon? I mean, David Spencer at the beginning spoke about, it was more of a political issue. He mentioned, I think he used the phrase overindulgence in self-praise. I think that was also a criticism that came last year. Mm-hmm. And I think that really has to do with the fact that you may see the economy, especially in terms of growth, and the opposition leader did pay attention to the issue of growth. You may see the economy growing in terms of figures, and you see the figures in the administration, the various ministers taking a lot of credit for a lot of what goes on. And I think particularly in a COVID-19 recovery context in 2021, as we look back, a lot of people were skeptical of, you know, exactly how much direct influence the government's decisions would have had on, I think it was 5.3% growth coming off of the back of 2020 when we were in lockdown. But anyway, Dr. Fontaine, what do you think were some of the critical openings or weaknesses, if there were any, that you think the opposition ought to have capitalized upon?
Okay, thanks, Kieran. I'm going to come to that momentarily, but I wanted just briefly to talk about the stimulus very, very quickly. You know, there is certain economics behind the whole stimulus idea. So, for example, in the U.S., a stimulus is given, the idea is to have people go out and spend that money so that they can stimulate the various businesses and stimulate growth. You don't have the same impact, the same effect within the Caribbean context. So, as I said previously, where the government has been able to maintain the workforce. I think that's a better strategy than probably just handing people cash, which may not have the same impact as it will have on those bigger economies. Now, on the question that you raised about the openness, I think one of the openness that was missed is on the area of the financing gap. As you rightly pointed out earlier, there's a $600 million financing gap. And the question becomes, where is this money going to come from? You know, how is it going to be financed? So, yes, we have a budget, a $1.6 billion budget. That's all well and good. But how are we going to finance it? Bear in mind, in the case of Antigua, you don't have the income taxes. So, almost exclusively, you're going to have to rely upon business taxes and loans. There is a limit to which you can keep raising business taxes. There, as I said, within the context of the COVID pandemic, you're going to find that those receipts are going to rise. You're going to have an increase in VAT, you're going to have an increase in customs and excise duties, simply because the goods coming in are more expensive. And at the same rate of taxation, your revenues are going to rise. But there is a limit to this. There's a limit to how much you're going to increase. So I don't expect, for example, the government to increase its business or tax revenues by 50%, for example, within the year. So it means that most of this is going to have to come from loans. The issue was raised by the opposition leader concerning the fact that the government is not able to borrow at concessional terms. And he made reference to the fact that other countries like St. Kitts, they went to the IMF and they were able to borrow at the rates of 2%. Now, that is good to a certain extent. The problem with these types of financing from the IMF, where you have traditionally low interest rates from 1.75% to 2%, the problem about that is that it is very restricted as to what you can do with that kind of money. So you can't, for example, put that into private sector expansion. You can use that to build roads and so on. So there are restrictions, which means the government would have to now go for commercial rates. So one of the issues I thought the opposition leader could have made is that this budget really stands the risk of plunging Antigua and Barbuda further into debt. Already with a debt to GDP ratio of 88%, I think the case can be made that if the government were to pursue its spending as it has laid out in its budget, that can increase clearly by 4 or 5 percentage points of GDP. And that should be a big concern for the people of Antigua.
Mr. David Spencer, what do you think in terms of overall the opposition's presentation in Parliament through the leader of the opposition, Mr. Pringle, and any of the points that have been raised thus far, particularly on this issue of the financing, whether or not you think that was a point that could have been pressed heavier or more heavily, rather? You may still be muted if you are speaking. Mr. Spencer?
Okay, so I'm here. Definitely, the issue of the fiscal gap and the overall management of the economy should have been an issue that the opposition should have raised. I noticed that the comparison kept being made and going back to 2019 as a base year and the performance of the Antiguan economy then. As an administration, one perhaps could look at the performance of the Antigua and Barbuda economy over the past 8 years. One of the panelists spoke about business cycles and so on. And yes, we do recognize those and how they may impact on an economy. We recognize that COVID would have been as maybe more devastating than the 2018 downturn in the world economy, which also would have and the UPP made the same arguments back then, that in light of what the level of aggregate demand would be maintained for the economy, so that there would be the continuous cycle of buying and selling, which would be necessary to keep economic activities at a certain level. Yes, so those are important. But what we we still grapple with is the performance of the Antigua and Barbuda's economy, not just over the immediate period, but also one has to take into consideration those years of plenty when the economy was supposedly doing well, and the extent to which the necessary measures might not have been taken to ensure the sustainability. For instance, I noted that this 2021 there was that the earnings from CIP was said to be 161 million, all right, but over the last 8 year period that would have amounted to, if we calculated at just about that as an annual average, to $1 billion at least. The issue was raised back then, and the advice given by one of the international funding agency, that the Antigua government should look at investing that windfall into wealth-generating ways. Unfortunately, and I must admit, that the whole existential nature of Antigua and Barbuda as a dependent economy that depends so much on imports, and as a primarily a mono economy dependent on tourism, that it might not have provided the flexibility, and that most of that money would have gone into recurrent expenditure. So that when COVID came around, unfortunately, it caught us or exposed those kind of glaring weaknesses in the economy. So while we grapple with the short-term challenges of employment, wages, the cost of living, we still need to be mindful of how, as a country, we can ensure that we can put in place those measures that we do not find ourselves in this situation again, where we scramble around with the Lesseber administration at the end of its tenure, with that albatross of the large public sector wage bill to face around its neck, that then limited its ability to undertake capital projects. We've seen it with the UPP again, and currently we're seeing it with the ABLP under Gaston Brown. One would have hoped, would have liked, and yes, I might be called a romantic idealist. One would have hoped that we would have been able to manage our economy better, and to the extent whereby we would have been able to put aside some of that windfall from the CIP in those kind of measures that would be able to absorb the shock from the current pandemic that we're facing.
Let me take the opportunity. We've unfortunately come to the end of our time, so I'll go around the panel and give everyone just a very brief moment to leave us with something in summation, if I could say that.
In summary, the conversations by the leader of the opposition regarding small business, mm-hmm. was one that I found interesting. I noted the notion of how many businesses were lost without any reference to how many businesses were the opportunity of COVID created. So I was looking for that balance there in that whole conversation. But I think my summary thought is that I'm hopeful that we do not restrict our conversations about the budget and the whole process and so on to end when the debates end, but that we use the opportunity to broaden, because we raise so many different topics today, and every day you hear the conversations, there are many other areas and avenues that we can begin to drill down and distill key issues, so that we can educate our population in general, so that we can separate, you know, the political hustlings from the realities of governance and growth and us as a people moving forward as a nation.
Carla Knight, your final words?
Yeah, I really just wanted to come in the back end of Mr. Spencer's point. I really could not agree more with the idea of, I think we need to have fiscal rules about our the way in which we allocate funds passed in Parliament, so laws passed in Parliament to sort of tie the hands of politicians. I think it's great, a great idea that when you have windfalls in terms of your revenues, how that windfall should be allocated or earmarked is important, because I think, as he rightfully pointed out, these things help to absorb the shock of negative economic shocks. But when you misallocate or you spend recklessly because you get this large sum of money in good times, then when the bad times come, you really are in a particular problematic state. So I really think that we need to have sort of fiscal rules in place to ensure that there's fiscal discipline insofar as how we spend revenue, such that we're able to manage any kind of emergency situation like a pandemic or like a negative economic shock or recession better. Beyond that, I think that the opposition, to my mind, has done a decent enough job trying to attack some of the major points of the budget. A lot of debates about the fiscal stimulus, I addressed it earlier. But we look forward to see more in the coming year and in the coming election season as to what is going to be the major points in this campaign.
And Dr. Thompson Fontaine, your final words that you'd leave us with?
Yes, certainly. If it's one thing the pandemic has shown very, very clearly to everybody, is that we have to reduce our dependence on a single or mono industry. And in the case of Antigua and Barbuda, depending on tourism. And as such, the whole idea of diversification becomes critical to that discussion. What I would really like to see Caribbean governments do more of is to focus on this issue. How can we diversify the economy? How can we create good paying jobs so that people will not necessarily want to work within government, that they can find good paying jobs within the private sector? So the question of expanding the private sector, the idea of attracting different types of industries into the Caribbean region, that I think a lot more effort and emphasis should be placed on going forward.
And very briefly, Mr. David Spencer, what would you leave us with?
Okay, so I go back to my opening comment that is still important for us to pay attention to, all of us, that we need to look at what is happening to poverty, what is happening to unemployment, and what is happening to inequality in the economy. And the extent to which these are being reduced is the extent to which we can say we are developing or we are making progress.
And with that, I think we can leave it there. I say thank you to Mr. Carlin Knight, socioeconomic and political affairs commentator. He joined us on Zoom. We were joined as well on Zoom by Dr. Thompson Fontaine, an economist currently working in South Sudan, Dominica National, a former senator there, and formerly an economist with the IMF as well. We were joined in studio, of course, by Ms. Peter Williams, an economist and statistician, and also a business management consultant. And finally, by Mr. David Spencer, a community activist and co-host of Movement Radio, which is a weekly program here on Observer Radio, which is dedicated to social and political activism. Thanks to all four of you for joining us this afternoon.